everybody. My name's Tara Lee. I'm an addict. This is a really nerve-producing kind of deal. But I'm happy to be here. I want to thank Edgar for throwing my name into the ring. And, you know, when he called me, of course, my ego got this big. And I said, oh, it'd be an honor. And then, you know, as time draws near and near, and now I'm here, it's like, oh, my God, what did I get myself into? But it is an honor to be asked to speak at any meeting. And I'm so sorry. There was a time when nobody wanted me around, so it's a good thing. There's some added pressure here, too, because it's the spiritual speaker. I would much rather be called the Sunday morning speaker. I can deal much better with that. And what I'm going to do today is share my experience, strength, and hope. I recently had a clean time anniversary. I celebrated 28 years on Tuesday. And I have not been able to... Thank you. I've not been able to get my key tag yet because I had to miss my home group to come here, but I will get it when I go home. Last night, Nikki said that the most important people in the room were the newcomers and not so much the old-timers, and that's true. But since this is just for today's program, sometimes the old-timers need just as much help as the newcomers. Different situations, but help is still needed. The solution is still the same. And so the way I keep my recovery is the way anybody coming into the program keeps their recovery, and that is I ask for help, I go to meetings, I get a home group, I got a sponsor, and I do the things that we're directed to do here. And it's been working for me day at a time. The clean date is not important, but it's important to me in that I've been doing something consistently over a period of time that has been beneficial for me. And for that, I'm excited. This has been one hell of a journey for me. I came from a gutter, and I'm here today. So the whole journey has been one spiritual awakening after another, after another, after another. So, I'll start at the beginning. I am the oldest of six children, and because I'm the oldest, I have a bossy nature, naturally, and that's one of the things I had to try to change when I got here. I was full of control, trying to control everything around me, and of course, you know what happened. Everything just fell apart. So I'm the oldest of six, and we grew up very, very poor. And I hear a lot of people say, well, that didn't bother me. I didn't even know I was poor. Well, I knew I was poor, and I didn't like it. I was shamed by it. I was embarrassed by it. My family is, my mother is Italian and Mexican. My dad's all Italian. So the all-Italian side kind of looked down on us because we had that Mexican in us. And so from the very beginning, I felt that kind of discrimination, and I felt less than my cousins who were pure Italian. And that started at a very early age. And I'm not exactly sure how or why, but there it was. And that's the way I found myself as I grew up, always feeling less than. I went to and not feeling comfortable in my own skin. In my household, there was a lot of domestic violence. And I think lots of people grow up with domestic violence and they don't become addicts. So I don't blame it on that. But it certainly contributes to the kind of issues I brought into the program with me. And I remember we used to walk, I'm from East Liberty, and we used, in Pittsburgh, and we used to call like the business section up street, so we would walk up street. And I could remember even back then being embarrassed because we all looked alike in my family. We were all like olive skin and black hair. And for some reason, that embarrassed me, and I don't know why. I went to Catholic school, and I thought all the other girls were prettier than me. I was pretty smart, but still I thought everybody was smarter than me. And I remember this one girl in particular, her name was Kathy Bruce, and she had red cheeks, rosy cheeks, and blonde hair. And we used to walk back and forth to school then. And we would walk by her house, and sometimes she would invite me in there. And I remember her brothers would be there, and somebody would be laying on the couch and just kind of relaxing. And I never could figure out how they could do that, how they could be so comfortable in their house, because we were not. There was always a lot of tension and anger in the house. So that was just another part of me feeling very different. So what I started to do before I even had a drug in me is I started to run away. And I would run away. I would pretend like I was going to school. I would throw my books in a garbage can or in an alley, and I would go. And I'm like 7, 8, 9 years old. I really didn't have anywhere to go, but I would go until my mother found me. And it's amazing. My mother today, she never gave up on me, never. Even when I was out there running around the streets, she would always come looking for me. She would always just miss me. But she always looked for me and wanted to help me. But the thing about it was, I couldn't receive help. I didn't know how to receive help. When along this journey, when I was using, people would try to help me. I've been to like many counselors, priests, that kind of thing. My mother would drag me, and they would offer me this help, and I couldn't hear it. I couldn't accept it. And I try to remember that now. For the, you know, I work in treatment, and I try to remember that, because many times people cannot accept help; they can't hear it, and that's okay. It just wasn't my time back then, and it might not be their time now. So I went through my whole life. I remember I started to use drugs when I was about 11 or 12. And I'm not going to bring you through a drug log, but I think it's important for me to mention that my first drug was glue. And I don't even know if people still do that. But I, you know, huffed this glue, and I loved it, because what happened was I was no longer that little scared girl who felt less than. Not exactly sure how I felt, because that's kind of a weird high, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter. I didn't feel like me, and that was the whole point. I didn't feel like me. And so that's how it was for me. I grew up doing drugs, causing problems, and from the very beginning, my drug use caused problems, because I was so young, and I grew up in an era where girls were not supposed to get high. I'm 62 now, so we're talking back in the late 50s, early 60s, girls were not supposed to be getting high, and I was running the streets, getting high, earned a very bad reputation, and always felt bad about that. I always let it bother me. And I remember this one guy who was a pure alcoholic said, "You know what your problem is?" And I said, "No, what?" He said, "You care too much." And I did. I cared. I always wanted to be the kind of person who did not care what other people think. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm a long way from where I was. So that's what happened. I just continued to use and use and use. Things got worse and worse and worse. And I actually went to reform school for a while, got really crazy there, came home, couldn't be at home, ran away at 15, and I was on my own from 15 till I got into the program. The weird thing about it is, it just occurred to me in the recent past few years is that back then I was homeless and didn't even know it. What I would do is I would stay at your house. I would be what you wanted me to be so that I could get your drugs and stay at your house. And that's just the way it went for me. I wish I could say that I was this big-time drug user, drug dealer, whatever, but it wasn't like that for me. It was not slick. It was not cool. It was not any of those things. And like I said, it caused me trouble from the very beginning. So I tried to, I went to treatment, not because I wanted to get clean, but because I was hanging out with these two guys. We were living in this room on Negley Avenue, and I believe the rent was like $100, $150, and the three of us could not get that together to pay the rent. So we found ourselves out on the street, and I decided to go into treatment because the guy that I liked at the time was going into treatment, so I followed. And at the end of the 28 days, they said to me, do you want to go to a longer-term rehab? We think you need it. And I said, sure. Not because I thought I needed it, but I had run out of options, and I needed that time to figure out what I was going to do, what my next move was going to be, because I had nowhere else to go. So I went to this treatment, and they would take us to meetings, and I do remember feeling, I believe something about the meetings. And I'm not sure what it was, but what I remember is people would reach out to me and they would say, keep coming back, and they hug me and they would smile at me. And there was that part of me inside that was yearning for that. And I connected with that. So that I still used after that, but when I went back, I had a good impression of meeting. And I'm really blessed because I hear a lot of people say now, I hate those meetings. They don't work for me and this and that. But there was something about the meetings that I liked. And what I think it was is that positive attention, you know, that I was kind of yearning for. So I ended up going to another longer-term rehab after that. And I was up in Butler. And I stayed clean for about 8 months, and I heard a lot of good things up there. I heard, don't get involved in a relationship for a year, and certainly I could understand why all of you couldn't be involved in a relationship, but I didn't have a problem. They said, you know, get a sponsor. So I considered myself a tough chick back then, so I figured I had to have a tough sponsor. And I picked a sponsor who had a chain hanging out of her pocket and walked like a man. And I thought, well, she'll be able to handle me. So I got her as my sponsor. But the thing was, you know, the truth always comes out. And the truth was that I was a scared little girl. So I spent most of my time hiding from this sponsor. And, I mean, she was really, she would do say things to me that I wasn't used to. Like, I was in rehab, and I'm sitting there reading a magazine, and she would say, put that shit away and read this book. And I would think, I would pretend like I would read the book, but in my mind, I'm saying, who the hell is she talking to? I can't understand this. Why, you know, why is this happening? So I spent most of my time hiding from her. And, then, this relationship thing, I actually got involved in a relationship before I left the rehab, and it was with an alumni of the rehab. This guy would come and share his experience, strength, and hope. I guess he made that spiritual connection with me. But, so he actually picked me up from the rehab. So you know the end of that, right? We ended up using together. The problem with that was he was 6'4", a huge bear of a guy. And, you know, when he wasn't using, like most of us, he was a nice guy. And when I wasn't using, I was a nice girl. But then when we started using together, all hell broke loose. And it became very abusive. And, of course, I was real comfortable with that. And I was never the kind of person who would run from the abuse. Again, not because I was tough, but but because that's what I knew. And it was familiar to me, so it didn't occur to me to leave this relationship. I actually got a scar from that relationship, so as a memory's sake. But so those are the things I heard. You know, get a sponsor, don't get involved in a relationship. And I twisted everything as a newcomer. I twisted everything in my mind, and I ended up using. Thank God I was able to get back into these rooms. And, you know, I wish I could say I came back because I made a decision to get clean. I liked what you had to offer. I wish it was common sense that came and shook me, and I woke up and realized what I needed. It wasn't that at all. I just found myself, after that experience with this new scar, ending up in the hospital, and they had a rehab there. And when I woke up, they asked me, can you do this? And I said, okay. But again, never making a decision. And so I stayed clean. That was, when I woke up that day, that was August 21st, and that's my clean date. And I've been clean ever since. Now, this whole journey of being clean has been one wonderful thing after another. I've learned so much here. When I got here, I could not talk to people eye to eye. And, you know, I've heard so many good things this weekend. I see Carla sitting there. She did such a nice job of explaining how fragmented I am. I mean, she explained it, and it was something I never actually could put into words. But it's that thing that happens when I interact with you, and that part of me that I've shut down, it's plagued me my whole life. Now, the wall has gotten weaker, the wall has gotten lower, and sometimes you can see through the wall, but the wall's still there. And that's what I mean about this is a day-at-a-time program. I am only as spiritually fit a day at a time, as long as I do what I need to do that day. And it gets better and better and better after time, but we're never cured. And those are still things that we need to work on. And she did such a nice job of explaining that. Then this morning, I heard this other lead. He explained that struggle we have with coming to grips with a higher power. He put it in the words that really I had never heard before, and he wasn't afraid to share it. One of the things that I heard was, if you're not praying, you're not staying. So I decided to pray, and when I would get down on my knees and pray, it was almost like, you know, when you smoke reefer or you drop acid and you get paranoid. That's what it was like for me. I got so paranoid, and I had to jump up. It was frightful because I was unworthy of anything loving. You know what I mean? I was unworthy, and I felt that. I lived that. I believed that. And, you know, when I came to these rooms, I had absolutely no values and no belief system at all. And now I do. What a miracle. So I stuck around, kept going to meetings, and at some point, you know, and I always used to think that I was like a mouse in a maze, and my higher power looked down at me and kind of picked me up and put me on the right path. And that's just something I think about, but I don't know if I actually believe that, but that's how I picture it in my mind. Because at some point, I started to believe in this program, and I struggled with the idea of a higher power. I was raised with a God, a certain image of God, and we've all heard this before, that God was judging, and I committed many mortal sins, venial sins, and, you know, I'm going to go to hell for. And so I started to try to have a God. My sponsor would tell me, your God has, your higher power has to be bigger than you and loving. And So that's what I tried to keep in mind as I went through this journey. I had about, during my drug use, I ended up getting married when I was about 20 years old because I thought that was going to fix me. Because of the way I grew up, I had no idea what a marriage was supposed to be like. I didn't know I was supposed to be 50% and he was supposed to be 50%. I believed that he was supposed to make me happy. And when he didn't make me happy, I left. And I had that idea in my mind from the very day when we got married because my maid of honor asked me, what are you going to do if this doesn't work out? And I said, well, I'll leave. Because that's what I did. I leave. I usually caused a big scene, broke some things, police came, and I would leave. And that was the way I handled. That was my problem resolution. So that's what I did. He didn't make me happy, so I left. The complication was I had a baby, and took the baby with me. And it's very hard to use drugs and have a baby, because what happens is you have to take the baby with you everywhere you go, no matter what you're doing. And that's what I was doing. I was bringing the baby into unsafe places. And at one point, I said to my husband, I said, you got to take Jimmy because I'm not doing the right thing. I was selling my food stamps, not waking up before him, not being a good mother at all. And for all the parents out there, you know that we love our kids so much. And that guy Adams said that again, too. He said having a child is like having permission to wear your heart outside of yourself, and that's what it's like. So I left him with his dad, and that only opened the door for me to get crazier and crazier. So I would use to kind of drown out the thought that I had a baby boy that was missing me. And I believe that if women weren't good mothers, they were less than dirt. And that's what I believed, and that's what I thought about myself. So I did not want to have a moment of clarity when I used, because I would think about him, and that pain was too great. But as parents, we know how much we love, but yet and still we pick that drug up. And it's amazing how much power that drug had over me. So now that I didn't have a baby boy with me, I went really absolutely crazy and went on self-destruct. But I was up in Butler, and I decided, well, I want to have a relationship with my son now. He had he's 7 years old. And his father had taken him to California to live, to get away from the rumors about me. So they moved back to Pittsburgh, and I decided I was going to start traveling down to Pittsburgh from Butler to see my son. And that's what I did. I was really trying to work a program. You know, we were going to meetings every day. I was really getting it. But it was difficult seeing my son because I didn't know how to be a mother. So I didn't have much money, but at that time, arcades were very popular, and he would love to go throw his money into the machine. And if I had $30, that's what he put in the machine, because I did not want to say no to him. I was fearful that if I said no to him, he would turn around and say to me, where were you? You weren't my mother. You know, give me those quarters. But I can joke about it now, but really it was a deep fear that I had. I could not say no to him. Even today, he's 38 years old now, I have a very difficult time saying no to him. I do. So anyway, so I started to have this relationship with my son that was based on fear. And all the relationships that I had in my life at the time were based on fear. I did not know how to have a relationship. When I was in the room, I would run around the room hugging everybody, you know, I'd look like a little social butterfly. But really inside, I was so alone. And I think everyone here knows what I mean when I say I can be in a room full of people and still be alone. So we know how to do that very well, and I did that. It was only as a result of working these steps that I began to open up and become the person I'm supposed to be. So the second sponsor I got was my mother figure. I actually moved in with her, and she would do my laundry and cook. That lasted a while. But then I decided to move back to Pittsburgh to be with my son full time. And so when I had about a year and a half clean, I moved back to Pittsburgh. During that time, during my first year of recovery, I had to have an operation. I had to have a gallbladder operation, and I had to take pain medication. And it was difficult, but I had a lot of people around me, and I was able to get through that and take the medicine as prescribed and stop taking it before I left the hospital. But that was like my foundation, going to a lot of meetings, hearing a lot of good things, having some good sponsors in my life when I moved to Pittsburgh. And I moved to Sharpsburg, where I'm back there now. But I started going to a lot of meetings in Sharpsburg, and I got another sponsor. Her name is Mary. And my sponsor is very different than me. I'm kind of a reserved, quiet person, and my sponsor is more outgoing. And so I really wanted what she had. I wanted to become that kind of free spirit that was not afraid to be myself. And I can remember, she didn't live too far from me in Sharpsburg. She lived right up the hill. And I remember when I would get dressed, at this one time in particular, I had on this blue jean skirt and I wanted to wear these big hoop earrings. And I had to go to her and say, is this too much? Do I look okay? Because I was just so unsure of myself. And my sponsor has always been a cheerleader for me. She never spoke a harsh word to me. She was always in my corner, always encouraging me, would share her experience, strength, and hope about the steps with me. And we worked through 1, 2, and 3 those first couple years. And I don't know. I hate when people say back in the old days, but back in the old days, it seemed to me that we worked slowly on the steps. But it's a new day in NA, and now people work it at their own pace, and I've grown to be okay with that. Going slow through the steps was my story. And the truth be told is I was a procrastinator. That's probably why it took me so long. She put me on the 4 steps, and I was on that step for quite a while. And I learned a lot of things about myself, though. I learned that I was a procrastinator. And I learned that I could take direction, which was something I was never able to do. And so I started writing, and of course I didn't know what I was doing. But I decided to do my 5th step with my sponsor. A lot of people choose not to do that. Back then, a lot of people were going up to the monastery. I chose to do it with my sponsor. And the reason why I wanted to do that is because I wanted somebody to know exactly who I was and be around me and love me anyway. It was almost like I needed some tangible proof of what you guys were saying. So I did that. I read my 5th step. Now, I didn't have any great, huge awakening, but what I did have was this huge sense of accomplishment that I was really working the program. I had some hard lessons. You know, when I was working step 1, my family is so damaged. I have 4 brothers and a sister. I have three brothers on methadone. And they're not just on methadone like for short-term use. They've been on methadone for years. I'm 62, so one brother's 59, the other one's 57, and the other one's 55. And they've been on meth for years, like 20, 30 years. So it's like the way of life with them. And the one brother in particular uses, and he's pitiful. And so my family is very damaged. And I forgot where I was going back, but that's okay. I know where I was. When I was working the first step, my dad was sick, and my brother, this one brother that was pitiful, was living with him. And I was clean, went to go visit my dad. Next thing I know, I'm accused of taking $1,500. Then it turned into $1,500 and a watch. I didn't take it, but here's what happened. My mother did not know who to believe. She didn't know whether to believe me or whether to believe my brother. And I was so hurt over that. And what I came to realize is I was absolutely powerless over what my mother thought, what my dad thought, what my brothers did, and it was a huge awakening for me to realize that. And it was a gift from God, actually, even though it kind of felt bad. I really learned that I was powerless, and I learned it through my family, and I've learned it again and again and again with my family. Because what's happened with being clean and getting responsible, my family has come to depend on me. Like when you're in the street, you come to me. I've had everybody in my family live with me, including my mother. And now I'm by myself again, so that's a great thing. But they don't like me sometimes because I'm bossy, they say. Or my mother will say, don't talk to me like that. You're not at work. You're not the boss here. So, but anyway, that's how I learned the first step through my family. But when I worked the fourth and fifth step, for me, it was tangible evidence that I was working a program. Because as I was going through 1, 2, and 3, I was taking direction from my sponsor, talking to other people about how they work the steps, and I was incorporating acceptance into my life, surrender, and all that faith, trying to get in conscious contact with the God of my heart, my understanding. I was doing all those things, but I was never really sure until I wrote my fourth step, shared my fifth step, and said, yes, I'm doing this. I'm working a program. And that was a huge awakening for me. At the time, my sponsor was heavily involved in service, and so I got involved in service, too. And through service, I gained a sense of identity, which was so important to me. You know, all my life, I was told that I had potential, and I'm sure a lot of you heard that, too. Why are you throwing your life away? You have so much potential. And when I did the service thing, and I would, write a report, be the secretary, whatever it was, I would get all these good jobs, doing a good job. And I ate that stuff up. I'm a person who needs positive recognition. And that's okay today. I like to be recognized for the good that I do. I also like to do good when nobody knows it, too. So it kind of balances stuff out. But I think positive recognition is good, especially when you've had terrible labels placed on you from your addiction like I did. You know, I had a bad reputation, and it really bothered me because I was supposed to be this good little girl, this good mother, and I had been none of that in my addiction. So when I started to work step six with my sponsor, I really, even then, believed that this fly is killing me. I really believed then that I did not have any defects. I could not think of a one. But here's the thing. After I read my fifth step, my sponsor said to me, now tell me what your strengths are. And I sat there for a long time. Trying to think what my strengths were. I couldn't think of any. And so being the cheerleader she was, she says, well, you're smart. I said, yeah, I'm smart. And so she starts giving me these adjectives, and I would agree. And that's how we got through the list of strengths. But so couldn't think of any strengths on my own. I couldn't think of any character defects. I needed the people in NA to teach me about defects. So you know what happens when you're on step 6 and 7. You recognize everybody else's defects and shortcomings. And so I was like picking you off like a sniper. You know, you're this, you're that. And all of a sudden now, I know everything about recovery when I'm on 6 and 7. And you would do this like I do this. And, you know, and I don't think I'm alone in that either. I think after we get a couple years clean, we all think, you know, I got this a little bit. And then you learn, as soon as you say you got it, then you don't have it. And I was saying to somebody, it's like this, like the spirituality thing. As soon as you say you're spiritual, you're not. As soon as you say you're humble, you're not. So it's a fine line. But as I started to recognize your defects, with the help of my sponsor, I started to realize that I was able to recognize your defects because I had the same defects. Oh my, what a blow to the ego that was. You know, that was mind-blowing. And I started to work a process on these defects. First, I had to recognize that I had a defect. Then I had to start praying and asking for help about this defect, right, and sharing about it. And at some point, you know, you get to the other side because we're solution-focused here, which is really amazing. You know, in addiction, we have absolutely no solution. And we come here and we have a solution. It's a miracle. So, I get through 6 and 7, and that's good. Everything's going along fine. I'm working now. I was unemployable. Now I'm working. I had all this potential, so now I start school. So things are going great for me, right? And I had about over 6 years. I decided that I knew more than my sponsor, so I got another sponsor. But being the fragmented person that I was, I hid from that new sponsor. She would give me direction, and I wouldn't do it. So it took me a long time to figure out I wasn't able to do this, and I needed to go back to my sponsor. I just was not ready. I was just like one-on-one. I wasn't good at all. I tried to have a couple relationships around this time, and it didn't work out. I did start to date. I had this criteria that I had when I realized maybe I should start dating. And the criteria was that he should have a job, that if he had kids, he should be responsible for his kids, and that if he had a mother and sister, then he should treat his mother and his sister as well. That was my criteria. That was a spiritual awakening for me, because before that, I had no criteria. If you showed me a pill, a joint, or a baggie, I was yours. Plain and simple. I mean, it's just, that drug overtook everything for me. So now, for me to have criteria, it was great. So I went out with this man, and of course, well, not of course, but this was the man that I had a relationship with, a real relationship, where we could sit down and talk about things. He had two boys, and by this time I had been taking care of my dad. That was another miracle for me, because as I was a kid growing up and a female using, shaming my dad, couldn't even go up the alley to play bocce anymore because of me, I was able to take care of my dad until he died, and that was a real blessing for me. So I was able to make living amends to him, and I'll be forever grateful for that. So with this guy, though, we decided that we were going to be together, that I was going to include accept his children, and he was going to indeed accept my dad. And so we got together. Now, by this time, I'm like 40 years old. He was 40. He had spent a long time in the penitentiary. So it was like we both were really appreciating what we were blessed with, and we came together. And we had a very nice marriage. We were not in a power struggle. And it was good. I was able to finish school, and he supported me going to school. It was great. We had a good life together. And then he was diagnosed. We dated about 18 months, and then we had a marriage for 10 years. Around that 10th year, he was diagnosed with cancer. And by the time he was diagnosed, he was already in stage 4. So he was dying. We didn't know how soon it was going to be, but we knew it was going to be soon. So he was actually diagnosed on my anniversary, August 21st, that he had cancer and that he was diagnosed with a terminal. And after spending some time in the hospital, I took him home, and he got really sick really fast. And so we had a hospital bed in the living room. And now this, for me, you would think that this is a very sad time. And it was a very sad time. But we were happy to be together. He accepted, this is crazy, he accepted dying better than he accepted the fact that he had to take medication. But he had to take it. And I was the administrator of the medicine. And this is, you know, talk about a silver lining. There was so much joy in us being together at that important time in his life. He was a very quiet, conservative guy. He was not a guy who would talk about God. He didn't wear his faith on his sleeve. Very quiet. And I remember one day, you know, I used to pull somebody up to get him cleaned up, to pull him up from the bed. And he looked right at me and he said, "There is a God." And I thought, wow, there is a God. My faith had been growing all this time, but he was so close to dying, and he said it, and I'm like, oh my God, it's a God. And that was a miracle for me. And we would talk together, and he was concerned about me, what would happen to me after this, and but by the time I met him, I was self-sufficient. I was working, I was taking care of myself, taking care of my dad, paying my bills to the best of my ability. And so that way, I kind of knew I was going to be fine. But we would talk about this thing, and it was great. And so he was diagnosed August 21st, and he died November 3rd. So what is that? It's about 3 months or so. And it came very quick. But I was so happy to have that time with another human being that was so intimate. You know, that was so private for him. Because he told me, he said, no matter who's around you when you're dying, you're alone. You know, I mean, what can you do? What can you say to somebody who's dying? It's a private journey. But I was able to be there with him on that journey, and I'll be forever grateful for that. That was in 2002, November. And so he'll be coming up on 10 years. So I had to get back to basics in the room, because even though I was in this marriage, I've been in this marriage, going to school, working, had gotten away from meetings a little bit, not going as much as regularly as I had been. So anytime I have a struggle in my life, I get back to basics. I increase my meetings. I call my sponsor more. And thank God I've been able to do that. And I've done it any number of times over my recovery, the idea of getting back to basics. So I got through that. I learned who I was again in the room. Now I was a widow, and my mother said to me after a while, she said, you know what, you're not a widow anymore, you're a free agent. that's my mother. So, recovery has been so very good to me. I have reached my potential. You know, I was able to get an education. I work. I'm not obligated to anybody. And that's huge for me because I was always obligated to you. I had to do what you wanted me to do. I had to be the kind of girl you wanted me to be because you had what I needed. You either had the drugs or the money or the place to live. I was always beholden to somebody else. And now, because I'm in recovery, I'm only accountable to myself and my higher power. And I have increased I don't understand my higher power, but I believe now that he understands me. So I've come from being unworthy to being understood. And don't we all want to be understood? He knows exactly what I'm thinking, what I'm going through. He's blessed me with this ability to put one foot in front of the other, which is so very good. Because I would always go backwards or run sideways. And now I'm able to go on a straight, positive path, one foot after the other, to find a solution for whatever problem I'm having. So this recovery's been this kind of joyous ride for me. And I've had my share of problems in N.A., and I've always been able to find a solution in N.A. So I'm so glad to be here. If you're new, I want to say keep coming back, even if you don't feel right, because you're learning something new. You're not supposed to feel right. It's not supposed to feel right. It's supposed to feel uncomfortable and uneasy, but you've got to stick around long enough for that feeling to move into something else. And that's what happens in recovery. Problems change, feelings change, things move. There's a process here that helps us to deal with our problems. And that's so great. You find out what your problem is here. You find out the solution here. And you're free to work through it with people who love you here. So I am so beholden to N.A., love N.A., and will keep coming to N.A. no matter how much clean time I have because this is where the solution is for me. Thanks.